Simon. I am the Ohio Secretary of State's regional liaison for Southwest Ohio. And I would like to, first of all, thank you all for coming here today for the work group session on illegal voting. And I would like to, first of all, go ahead and introduce our panel members today. We first have Mr. Dale Fellows, who is a member of the Lake County Board of Elections. We have Ms. Karen Newman, who is a legal director for Fair Elections Legal Network. And we have Ms. Eleanor Spielman, who is the general counsel and director of legal services for the Ohio Secretary of State's office. And so, first of all, what I wanted to do is go ahead and start out the discussion. And by all means, this is if you have any questions, remarks, or comments, please feel free to come to the mic and share your experiences. And because we'd like to make this more of a discussion and get as much input from you, the audience, as well. So the first question we have for the panel today is in the area of voter registration groups. In 2008, serious concerns were raised regarding organizations that pay either by the form or by the hour for voter registration drives. The most widely stated issue regarded some rogue voters of these groups that allegedly engaged in voter registration fraud in an effort to make more money rather than an effort to engage in illegal voting. Given these facts, what restrictions should be placed on these organizations? And what state, federal, and constitutional rights impact attempts to limit their activities? And Ms. Newman, if we can start with you on this discussion.
Thank you. Let me first say that our organization did a lot of, can people hear me? Our organization did a lot of work advising voter registration groups on compliance with state voter registration laws, and it was unfortunate that they were operating in a climate of well-publicized misconduct by one or two other organizations. And it's our perspective and belief that most voter registration groups took their jobs very seriously, wanted to comply with the law, wanted to understand the law, and sought out our assistance and worked closely with election officials to make sure that they were conforming with the law as well. In terms of requirements, in terms of requirements for that should be imposed on these organizations, my view is that they should be, somebody in associated with one of these groups should obviously receive training about what the law and requirements are so that they can then train their members. Some states have very stringent requirements, training requirements, and certification requirements, which are very burdensome and are often associated with criminal penalties for failing to obtain certification. And I think that has a very chilling effect on these organizations. No one is saying, I'm certainly not saying that people shouldn't be informed of the law or comply with the law, but I think excessive training requirements are counterproductive. I think I would leave it to the election officials to opine about what their perspective is on any requirements, and I'd be interested in hearing what their views are on what they think should be required of these organizations.
Thank you, Ms. Newman. Ms. Spielman?
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm glad to see people are still here at this hour after 2 days of conferencing. Let me just first state a couple of obvious points, or at least one obvious point. I think it's obvious to all of you folks. I know we've got a lot of SOS people in the room and some election officials as well and some other interested people. But my obvious point is that voter registration and irregularities or fraud or whatever kind of improper label you want to put on improper conduct in the area of voter registration is one thing, and it should not happen. But when it does happen, there are still a number of safeguards built into the system which will correct or eliminate that illegal act leading to an illegal vote. And it's very important that we keep that distinction in mind as we discuss this. And it's very important, I think, that the public learn that differentiation. I believe in the November election that did occur, but it took some time. I believe the media over time drew that line, although perhaps at the beginning it might not have been so obvious to a lot of people. In terms of the pros and cons of allowing advocacy groups candidates, political parties, any kind of civic organization to do voter registration drives. Obviously, that's built into the system for decades. I think it is worth thinking about whether we may rely too much on those. I just came out of a session in which Professor Candace Hoke spoke, and she made a strong pitch for having automatic adult registration built into the system so that every person, I think the argument sometimes made that the government can find an 18-year-old male for purposes of registering for the draft, there ought to be a way that the government could identify people and get them on voter registration lists. So that's a topic that's worth thinking about and discussing the pros and cons about. I think I'll leave it at that in terms of the first question. We'll let Dale Fellows.
Thank you, Ms. Spielman. Mr. Fellows?
Thanks, Eleanor. Great to be here. Appreciate the opportunity. With the first question being, you know, talking about the rogue workers and whether or not they should be paid, I guess is one question. We had an incident in our area where you had a non-U.S. citizen was registered, even though she clearly told the person and checked off petition. It was a petition drive, actually, where they were also registering people to vote because they wanted to make sure the valid signature, and they altered the box, and they were just saying, I'll fill in the information, you just sign. Those are the types of things that obviously we need to make sure doesn't happen, and you wonder if money is the reason why folks are out there doing those types of registration drives when you have, as Eleanor pointed out, lots and lots of other organizations who are doing it, you could say for their own self-interest, which are political candidates and that type of thing. So they're doing a pretty good job. So I guess the question becomes, should they even be allowed to be paid for that exercise? And there are, as Eleanor mentioned, lots of safeguards and things. You know, when you have the registration, you have your 60-day notice that goes out. You have your return. You're doing verification, your confirmation of where they live and all that. But one of the things too that needs to be addressed is we have so many organizations out there that are doing this that you end up with multiple registrations. You get everybody, the same person is registering 6 or 7 or 8 times, and we have to go through the exercise of putting them into the database and discovering they're already there. And of course, it always happens right at the end of the process when you're also trying to get ready for the election. So those types of things just bog down the whole system. And again, I guess you go back to if their person's getting paid, especially by the how many folks they're allegedly registering, you know, that's how they're getting paid. It makes for a tough time for us at the boards of elections.
Thank you, Mr. Fellows. Do we have any comments or concerns from the audience? Maybe questions for the panel before we move on? So the next question that...
Wait,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Go ahead, ma'am.
Come on, there was any doubt in your mind. I in the last session on ID, I said to everybody, you got to come to this session too. There's just a number of things. Okay, Acorn has a problem. They do pay, it's legal, it's the only way they can get people to go do registrations in areas of high poverty, people who are homeless. These are hard groups to get to, and they pay them. There was no attempt of any of these folks to vote illegally. They were just making a little money by registering people. I didn't see anybody complaining about the multiple registrations back when we had the drinking age in the ballot, and kids were registering in every bar in a college town because they wanted to be sure they could vote so they could raise the drinking age. So there's a lot of fear-mongering going on, and I don't think election officials have been doing enough at countering that fear-mongering. Mickey Mouse is not going to show up at the polls and vote. We know that. If we are so concerned about the possible fraudulent voting, we know that it's one or two people here or there, but let's be equally concerned about the hundreds of people who are disenfranchised because of some technical mistake that they've made. And I go back to the 1,000 voters in Franklin County who everybody acknowledges were eligible voters, but because of a technical flaw in their voting, they were disenfranchised. That's voter fraud to me, people being disenfranchised who were eligible to vote. Why aren't we as concerned about those hundreds or thousands as we are the one or two people who may try to vote illegally? And I insist we do catch them. We have all these very good systems in place to keep people from voting illegally. It works fine. So let's put equal amounts into not disenfranchising hundreds of people who make little errors along the way. And I may be back.
Thank you, ma'am. Did we have any, Ms. Newman?
One thing I just want to make sure that we're clear about, it is legal for voter registration workers to be paid hourly in most, if not all, states. I don't think that's what the concern is. I think the concern is paying them per registration collected, which shouldn't be tolerated anywhere, precisely because it creates these perverse incentives that most people in this room have had to deal with firsthand. The other thing I just want to add, that at least one federal court has found a federal right for these third-party voter registration groups to assist voters register to vote. So I don't think you're going to eliminate voter registration groups, but I think to the extent that their operations burden officials, that those are problems that can be addressed in terms of the timing of when forms are deposited with officials for processing. I mean, I'm sure nobody here wants to be faced with a mountain of voter registrations at the 11th hour. And in terms of illegal votes that are illegal registrations or improper registrations that are collected, we know that the laws work. Existing laws already work because we've seen a lot of prosecutions during this last election cycle of an organization who had some registration workers engage in illegal activity collecting registrations.
Any other comments on that topic from the panel?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Okay, Mr.
Here's the thing. I mean, you've got folks out there who I think certainly are trying to test the system, if for lack of a better term. I mean, you've got folks, I mean, in our area where not just registrations, but in absentees where we had folks calling, and I think, Peg, you've mentioned one thing. It's due to the due diligence of the people in the 88 county boards of elections as to why we don't have quote-unquote rampant illegal voting. It's because they take their jobs very seriously and go that extra mile and make darn sure that folks, are voting who should be able to vote. But number two, I hate to hear that we're trying to disenfranchise. All I ever see in all the years I've been doing this is every single elections official in the state wanting to do everything they can to get everybody to vote, and as many people as can be. But again, you want to make sure that they truly live where they live, and they truly should be voting. I mean, I'll give you three examples in Lake County. We had a couple in New York. They had moved from Lake County a couple years ago. They applied for a absentee ballot, and when we did our due diligence and our confirmation card came back, and we had another couple in South Carolina did the same thing. When we did our due diligence and actually called them, we found out their reason they wanted to vote in Ohio because their vote would count more in Ohio than where they're at. And the New York couple was already registered in New York, but they were still registered in Ohio too. And we had a gentleman in Chicago who had left a couple years back, and he clearly said, when he said, well, yeah, I'm a resident of Illinois, but my vote's going to count more in Ohio. So those are the types of things that, again, with the due diligence out there now, I don't think, and then you've got Lorain County, you've got You know, some of the college students that come down from Canada, and they're attempting to register to vote in the U.S. and trying to vote here. I mean, those are the types of things that, again, with our due diligence, but we have to be that, as I call it, like the homeland security of elections. We've got to anticipate what's going to happen, what could happen, how people could try and illegally vote or try and manipulate the system, so we can always stay one step or two steps or three steps ahead of the of those folks. But I don't think we should be thinking that it's not in, that there isn't some attempts to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Fellows. Ms. Spielman, do you have anything to add?
I want to get in on this real quick. I just want to make the point that in living in a democracy, all of us are dependent in one sense on everyone else's, the collective respect for the law. And I want to make an analogy with filing your income taxes. Everyone is required to file, as we all know at this season, to pay your taxes and file your tax returns, and most people do it. I believe that the same is true in terms of voting. Most people understand that voting is a privilege. They want to take advantage of that privilege, but they don't want to game the system. The Bible, I believe, or someone at least at one point said that we'll always have the poor with us. Well, we'll always have the rogues and the bad guys. And Dale's point, which I want to wholeheartedly endorse, is that we've got hardworking board members and staffs that probably do a whole lot better keeping a clean election system than the IRS does in enforcing the tax laws. So I think it's important that we keep this in perspective and not allow ourselves to be sucked into stories of fraud when it is not a rampant problem.
Thank you, Ms. Spielman. We have Ms. Shirley.
Yes, my name is Shirley Frazier. I'm administrator at Board of Elections in Hamilton County. Just to keep this in perspective as far as the groups that are out there that are doing registration drives, I worked very closely with the ACORN group. And they do have workers that are not above board and fill out various forms for fictitious people that do not exist. And with that, you know, it burdens the process of trying to make sure that you are processing each registration form that they bring in. With that, there's added effort to try to read the form. They're illegible. Donald Duck, Mickey Mouse might be on the form. You know that person doesn't exist. But the problem is, we found with working with ACORN and trying to talk with their regional manager and things of that sort, we would have to take in every form that they brought in, whether it was legible or illegible, whether it said Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck. We still had to take the time and the effort to process that. Now, when you see something that says Mickey Mouse on it, obviously you're not going to put that in your database. But considering that, you know, you've got these stats of registrations that they bring in, and they would typically wait till about 5 till 4 to drop them off. And say that we're at the point where we're in the phase where registration is about to close for the incoming election. They'll wait to 5 to 4 every day and bring in thousands of registrations. I was the lead supervisor, so I'm speaking from actual things that I know happened. And so you would have to look at each form. You would have to cut the form off. Sometimes they wouldn't even cut the forms off, you know, where you would have to perforate it, which takes time. Then you got to clock them in as the date that you received them. Then you have to scan them and batch them and put them in to be data processed. With that, you know, we would have conversations with the regional manager telling her of the problems that we were having. But this would always persist. And finally, it got to the point where we did have to have some of their people brought in, and some of them were prosecuted. But the situations and the problems would keep occurring. So how can you say to some organizations, well, I'm just saying ACORN, there were other groups out there, but ACORN was the one that really presented the problems. We had registrations coming in from the NAACP local chapter, the Philip Randolph group, different groups like that. And they wouldn't bring in as many. So Acorn people would also have like various cards, like 25 cards to one person's record. Some of them were good cards and most of them were bad cards. When we would call the individuals, if they would provide a phone number, and you find out from the conversation, well, no, I didn't fill out that card, I didn't do that, but that card would still be on that person's record. Then that tumbled into another problem because we had the new system where you could bring in your cards and you put the image of that record on that person's record. Well, then we found out that our system could only hold so many cards. So then you had to arbitrarily say, okay, which cards am I gonna take off? So it was causing so many other problems on the back end, which would then also cause a problem for us to meet our deadline, you know, for voter registration, close of voter registration. So we would work long hours, 16-hour days sometimes, trying to get all of these bad registrations in. So what do you do? I mean, you can't say to the group, you can't be out there filling out these cards for people. What do you do?
Thank you, Ms. Frazier.
I got, you said it great too at the beginning about the legibility. I mean, I have to believe that sometimes the legibility is such that you actually end up registering somebody that's, because you're using a different date than maybe or different information, you're interpreting that writing one way and it's different. You end up with somebody else on the voter roll that doesn't even exist. So you end up with that kind of situation where you're actually creating a new voter, if you will. I mean, that's one of the problems. And I don't know, maybe I'm just throwing out some ideas. You know, is it the ability, do you have the ability, maybe not by law, to decertify organizations? Or, of course, the organization will just turn around and change its name. Or is it the persons that are actually circulating? If they're doing it wrong, if they're doing it fraudulently, then I think we have to do our due diligence with our prosecutors and whoever to take those folks to task, so make sure it doesn't happen, because then it sends a strong message to others. But I know that the prosecutors are like, this isn't like a high priority to them. So,
thank you, Mr. Fellows. Ms. Newman?
Just a couple of thoughts. First of all, some states do decertify voter registration groups if there's not strict compliance with the law. I'm very sympathetic to the plight of election officials who were working 16-hour days longer trying to process these forms. There are a couple of issues, though, to keep distinct. I think these groups, and ACORN in particular, is a huge organization, and its mission was, during the election, to register as many unregistered voters as possible, and it has a right to do that, and it will do that, and it does create a lot of work for officials. So I think the challenge here is to find a way for an organization like that to be sensitive to the needs of officials and work with officials to try to come up with some sort of schedule or arrangement to turn those forms in. That's very different from ACORN as an organization whose workers may be turning in fraudulent or illegal forms, and that shouldn't be tolerated. There's no right for any organization to turn in illegal forms or engage in illegal voting activity.
Thank you, Ms. Newman. Ms. Spielman, do you have anything to add?
Well, as long as we're talking about the law prohibiting certain activities like this, again, let me state the obvious, that jail can be a pretty
effective deterrent.
Yeah, it can be an effective deterrent. And the code has identified, over the years, the General Assembly has identified all different kinds of ways that people can interfere and try and game the election system. And there are a lot of statutes setting out that all of these different ways of gaming the system are illegal. And these are not, you know, it obviously depends on the egregiousness of the activity, but these are felonies. These are crimes that people can go to jail, and not just for, you know, a short period of time, but a year or more. And I think it is important to keep that in mind as well as we go through this discussion.
Thank you, Ms. Spielman.
And let me also add that this is not a situation where where someone paying attention will not know, can say, I wasn't aware it could be a crime because all of these pieces of paper conspicuously display the fact that if you're gaming the system, if you're making a statement fraudulently, this is a felony.
And there have been very, very visible prosecutions of these people who engaged in exactly that kind of behavior, so it is not a mystery.
I absolutely agree that we've got to find ways for quality control without discouraging registration activities. We've also got a court order that we need to look at, the Project Vote versus Blackwell, that stopped some aspects of prior legislation from being implemented because indeed they found that it was too restrictive on registration groups. So it's a complicated thing, but I think that we should sit down and roll up our sleeves and really deal with it. I wonder whether we can change the registration form to include fields for phone number and email address so that we can get in touch with voters more easily and try to straighten some of these problems out. I think that would require legislative change as well, but it's something to think about. One thing I really wanted to make the point that what I worry about when I hear these voter fraud concerns is that they are often not balanced against the harm of the proposed solution. And the proposed solution is the restrictive voter ID rules. And I believe that the statistics that I've seen are that there are many fewer incidents of voter fraud, and I'm not talking about registration fraud, I'm talking about voting fraud, compared with a huge number of people that end up being disenfranchised by these draconian voter ID rules. And so, I'd like maybe the panel to address that a little bit. For me, that is the biggest concern. I think it's always a balancing act. You've got to balance the harm against the solution. Are you throwing out the baby with the bath water here?
In terms of a balancing test, courts do direct that legislatures have an articulable interest in the law that they're trying to enact, and that law is tailored to achieve that interest precisely to avoid excess or unintended harms. So I think that's something that legislators keep in mind. And it is a balancing test.
Yeah, and I think to answer your question, what my point is there's things that happen or are stopped from happening, so they're not part of the statistics. And so when someone says, okay, Gonwer report that just came out a week or so ago that I think came from the Secretary of State's office, had 5% of the rejected ballots, absentee ballots, were because of potential illegal voting, if you want to call it that, or potential double voting, or that they've already voted before. And I don't know if you want to consider that. Is that considered illegal voting, or is it considered that they made a mistake and they forgot that they had ordered an absentee ballot and now they went on election day to do it? Or a situation we had where a young guy, a college student, applies for an absentee ballot, goes to one of the colleges, everybody's getting excited, they're all going to go vote together, they all go vote, and meanwhile we're getting ready to send him an absentee ballot, and we find out when we were doing, again, our due diligence, that he voted somewhere else. And the story is, we gave him a call, got him out of a bar, and told him, you're trying to illegally double vote. And oh my God, and he gets all freaked out. Well, rightly so. When you say you're about ready to commit a felony, so you get his attention. But the point is there's a lot of things that go on, or attempts that go on, that aren't part of any statistics. So we have to, we're the front line in the, as I call it, the election security or homeland election security, however, and we've got to do our due diligence. But most of the organizations are doing a great job. Voter registration is going on by great organizations like the NAACP, the different advocacy groups that are doing it right. And we need to penalize those ones that aren't doing it right and are bogging down our system.
Incidents of absentee ballot fraud can't really be used to support an in-person voter ID law.
If you might want to go back to the podium.
Well, while she's moving, let me just make a comment, and that is that for decades we've had voter ID in Ohio, and it's called the signature requirement. There are lots of states where to this day that's all that's required, and in Oregon, their vote by mail requires a signature as the method of establishing identity. And let me just say, you know, on a personal level, I've been married to the same man for 30 years, and we have banking, online banking, and I know his mother's maiden name, and I know his social security number by heart, and I know a lot of things about him, and I have no problem accessing information using the information I know. But when it comes to endorsing a check, as long as I've known him and as many times as I've seen that signature, and I have tried, I'll admit, to forge it, it's not easily done. And you can't vote in Ohio without providing a signature which matches a record that the board has.
Ms. Frazier?
Okay, I just wanted to, you know, reemphasize here that ACORN, I wasn't so much concerned about voter fraud with ACORN. It was the registration fraud that they emphasized on. And with the ID requirement, which was box 10 on our form, you know, they would put the last four digits of anybody's social security number, which on the back end was actually somebody else's last four digits. So that created, you know, a whole slew of problems. And even with on our registration forms in Hamilton County, we have a spot on there to provide your telephone number, you know, to try to reach you in case we have a question about something that you may not have filled out on that form. And then with the phone number that they may provide, it wasn't the person's phone number who they had listed on the form. So they know what to fill out on these forms. They know how to get around saying that a form is not in completed correctly, but then the information becomes skewed.
Thank you, Ms. Frazier. Anyone from the panel would like to respond? Sure, ma'am.
I have two comments. One is, as I understand it, ACORN was pulling out the ones that they knew were bad and bringing them in, at least to Franklin County. Okay, here are our registrations. I agree they shouldn't be thousands at a time. But they're legally required to turn in all the registrations, including Mickey Mouse. But they pulled in and they turn in two batches. These ones we think are good. These ones we think are phonies. But we still have to turn them in. Can we do something to change the law? See, I don't know how to fix this because we don't want registration drives saying, oh, we're not going to turn these in. But somehow, if they've got a bunch identified as phonies, the board shouldn't have to go through all of this. And I've got two other comments. One is if you vote absentee and then go to your Board of Elections and vote a provisional ballot, that's legal under Ohio law. You are not attempting to vote twice. That's perfectly legal. That's proper procedure. And finally, I don't think voting's a privilege. It's a right.
Thank you, ma'am. And before we move on, I just wanted to, anyone who just joined us, I just want to let you know that the sign-in sheet's floating around. So please make sure you sign in before we leave. And so if we have any more comments from the panel on this topic. I'd like to move on to our next question here. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
You will all be very happy to know that I am Teresa James with Project Vote, who works very closely with ACORN. It is not part of my work currently to work with voter registration. Are you able to hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I do want to address some of the comments that have been made today. And first, I want to address the issue of the workload that fictitious registrations puts on boards of election and the workload that duplicates place on boards of election. I do want you to know that part of my job in 2006 was to advise ACORN and to help develop training programs. And please be assured they were well advised of Ohio law and what was required on voter registration forms. And they were further well advised of the need to train canvassers that submitting fictitious registrations was a felony in the state of Ohio, and that they would not only be prosecuted, but that ACORN would cooperate in any prosecution. And we have done so, or they have done so. I'm not working with them currently. Also, as Peg Rosenfeld pointed out, these organizations engaging with paid canvassers, there is an inherent problem with that both ACORN and the boards of election are dealing with, and we know what that is. They're not invested in this work. They're invested in the paycheck. And some will game the system. And despite developing with every election cycle an ever more complicated quality control system, we will find that some of ACORN's canvassers do game the system. And when they do, we do report that. In fact, we have a situation in Pennsylvania in which we reported in April a problem with a canvasser to the prosecutor, and that prosecutor was not interested. This is apparently a problem that boards of election have also encountered. But please be assured, despite the real problems that we see here with paid canvassers, there is a strong intent and effort on the part of that organization to avoid it. Because the simple truth is, ACORN does not want to pay workers to do fictitious cards. It doesn't advance the mission, and it certainly harms the community. It's not what they're about.
Can I ask a quick question? Did they pay them by the person or by the hour?
By the hour. It's $8 an hour, as far as I know. And never has been per card. And it's also specifically illegal in the state of Ohio to pay per card. There is a statute specifically saying that.
Is that right?
Yes.
Looking at me, where are my election lawyers? Is there anything in Title 35 prohibited?
I believe. Right, in Project Black Vote versus Blackwell, it was not, paying per card was not an issue, and that was not enjoined. But it is a matter of state statute under Chapter 35, although I can't recall the exact site at the moment. But that said, I would like to propose three possible solutions we might consider to this dilemma that ACORN faces and you on the ground daily with thousands of cards you have to deal with face, and that is to reduce the need for third-party registration through paid canvassers, particularly in this population that's targeted by ACORN, which it is generally less represented historically in the electorate. And that would be a solution that was brought up in the last workshop that I was in, and that was on NVRA implementation, I believe. And that was that we move toward considering studying modernized voter registration or automatic voter registration. I think that's a promising area, and I would hope that Ohio moves toward considering that. And the second is just simply implementing the law that is there now. Under Section 7 of the National Voter Registration Act, public assistance agencies are to offer opportunities to register to each client that comes in to apply for benefits, to recertify or renew benefits, or just to change their address. We are not finding that the numbers are coming in of registrations from public assistance agencies, and I understand the Secretary of State's office is working on that, and it's a matter of litigation, so I won't discuss it any further. But that is one source of significant registrations. And the other is a law that Florida first implemented in this election, this past election, and that was registration portability. In the state of Florida now, if a person moves anywhere within the state and fails to update their registration, I believe there's a time limit on that also, they may vote in their new precinct by filling out an affidavit. Of course, they have to give their standard ID, which is also a protection against election or voter fraud as opposed to registration fraud. Yep. That enables them to do away with a lot of provisional ballots, which are also a burden on boards of election, and to do away with the loss of a vote from an otherwise eligible person with safeguards built in. And I would ask that, or people consider supporting legislation such as that. And thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. And actually, to move on to the next question here, to the next segment, which is identifying illegal voting. While much was made of fraud in 2008, illegal voting appears to have remained a very infrequent occurrence in Ohio. So for future elections, what criteria would you suggest be used to determine if a vote was cast illegally? And Ms. Newman, if we can start with you on that.
Sure. When we talk about illegal voting, I assume we're talking about double voting and impersonating someone at the polling place, both of which are extremely rare. I suspect, quote, double voting is probably more prevalent than impersonation voting. And I think even with double voting, there has to be an inquiry about intent, whether we're talking about the confused college student that got dragged out of the bar because he couldn't figure out that he had already registered and was trying to register again, or if we're talking about someone who's intentionally trying to, cast their vote all around the country to influence the outcome of an election. Many states already have statutes governing this with standards to guide the inquiry that has to be undertaken by election officials, and so I certainly wouldn't say that new laws are required to prevent these very, very unusual occurrences of illegal or fraudulent voting.
Before we move on, if anyone finds a cell phone in the room, if you could please take it to the front desk. We have a missing cell phone, so if you find one, if you could please just report it to the front table. Ms. Spielman?
Well, let me just point out that the criteria are already in place. We have laws, we have procedures, we have directives, and it's not a question whether a vote is legal or illegal, and the election officials understand those rules and follow them. So I think maybe, I'm not quite sure what that question is going to. I do want to make the point, and maybe this is a cop-out, but I want to make the point anyway. We live in a country where 2 months before an election, there is a great deal of media attention to what's going on in a 24-hour news cycle out in the real world of the elections. And there's non-stories and there's stories. And the 99% of the activity, which is perfectly legal, is not a story. We experienced that, I believe, to a high degree in terms of this very issue of voter registration irregularities, fraud, whatever, in the last election. And I think it goes without saying that creates a perception that may inflate the severity of the problem.
Thank you, Ms. Spielman. Mr. Fellows?
I agree with Eleanor. I mean, the criteria is there. It's just a matter of when we identify something that's suspicious or something that has happened, is there the resources within the prosecutor's office or whoever to go ahead and prosecute those folks and make the example? We've had that situation in our county, not necessarily with the voting, where we made a pretty strong example of somebody who was trying to do it on the petition drives and things like that. And that's what we need to do. And again, I just reiterate, we as at the forefront of the elections officials and the staff are doing a great job of making sure that working that system and making sure it doesn't happen. I mean, one of the things that we haven't touched on is duplicate resolution. And it was mentioned in a couple of the other sessions, and that's so critical to our system, to making sure that we are quote unquote deduping registrations throughout the state of Ohio, so somebody can't go from one county to another to another. And as some of the counties said earlier, at some point during the elections process, they end up having to stop that. And it's usually at a critical time when people are voting. And so but that's another resource issue. You've got only X amount of time and X amount of days and X amount of personnel to be able to conduct the election in the right time frame. And so right now, like in our county, we're doing it on a daily basis. And then you're interacting with the other counties and making sure that either you're keeping it and merging in your county or you're merging it the other way. But, you know, then it becomes, it's a resource issue. And, but we have to make sure that, how about the folks who like to drive in from other states and stop by and say, okay, I'm going to register in Ohio and vote and then go back to wherever it is they really live. I mean, that's another issue that, again, we have to have places in place. Of course, I didn't want to turn this into a how-to type of seminar. But, those are the things that we have to always be concerned about. The Golden Week, I think, is another one. I mean, that obviously has a potential issues, and maybe one of the resolves there is just not having in-house voting during that time frame, because we have to have our time to confirm whether or not those folks are, in fact, registered before their vote actually gets counted. Things like that, and again, it's the practical side of things that the elections officials deal with day in and day out, some of which can be done real easily and some of which take some resources to do.
Thank you, Mr. Fellows. Do we have any, ma'am?
Me again.
Go ahead. Sure.
I think that the reason that this question is on here is because there are concerns that allegations of fraud, which I believe to be overblown, like I said before, are going to be used to initiate more draconian rules, specifically on the issue of HAVA matching, and I don't think we've seen the end of that. And requiring a perfect HAVA match in an imperfect system where there are all sorts of reasons why the voter's identification information may not match in the database. So again, I say that we have to look at how, whether we really have a problem that needs to be addressed here or whether these trumped up problems are being used to further hobble voters' ability to exercise their franchise.
Well, I'm not sure how they're trumped up when I just told you ones that we've actually had just in our county. And you can go to probably 88 counties and find situations where it was a potential situation. And so, I mean, it's upholding the integrity of the elections process and making sure that everybody's vote who should be voted has that right to vote. And no one else is disenfranchised by someone else who voted that shouldn't have voted and doesn't even live here. So I don't think it's trumped up at all. When I say trumped up,
I mean exaggerated to a certain degree. And some of your examples about voter fraud are related to absentee voter fraud, and that's not a reason for enhanced voter ID requirements for in-person voting, which is.
But you can make the argument, like you're saying, not to use a whole lot of time and resources on something that you feel is a small portion of the situation. You can make that same case about voter ID, that we're making a lot of accommodations and things for a very small population of folks who don't have.
It's not a small population.
And well, we're not in voter ID. I'll be more than happy to debate you on voter ID at a different time, I guess.
It's related. Yeah. And there are statistics that show that 6% of the population has a lot of trouble coming up with the kind of ID that you and I might find to be simple and easy to produce.
Thank you, ma'am.
I just would comment that, keeping the discussion back to the problem with illegal voting, I think the point is whether or not the allegations are exaggerated or whether or not they're actual, the point is that there are existing laws in place that officials are well trained in and enforce when they encounter these problems. And the problems are, in my view, very, very minimal. But I think that there's no need to enact burdensome laws because there are procedures and rules in place that already address these problems very effectively, as we've seen.
One of the things, too, I'll suggest, too, is one of the pluses in Ohio is that we do have a decentralized form where it is really locally based. So when a lot of folks will know other people or know, it was pointed out in one of the other, know different street terminology and things like that, that helps. And also the fact that we have multiple voting systems is a huge help in keeping away from any type of broad-based illegal type of activity. And so the issues are in place. And I'm not suggesting that there's illegal activity in a concerted effort. I'm just advocating the fact that we're doing a good job of making sure that the votes are counted correctly and folks and you don't have those issues.
And again, I would just add that in addition to existing laws, there are theoretically already tools in place for officials in Ohio and around the country through technology, through the requirement of statewide voter registration databases to detect this activity and respond accordingly.
Thank you. Ma'am, if you'd like to ask your question.
Thank you. My name is Carrie Davis. I'm counsel for the ACLU of Ohio. And I really want to speak to this third question that's on our sheet. And Mr. Fellows briefly mentioned Golden Week, as it's become known. I think certainly it's important that when boards of election are confronted with suspected cases of fraud, that be investigated. Because frankly, our election workers are our front line of defense in that regard, in investigating legitimate concerns about fraudulent activity. However, in doing that, it's imperative that we are careful not to suspect people for what is otherwise lawful activity. And we saw in certain parts of the state, thankfully not statewide, but certain parts of the state this last election cycle, there were a lot of people who faced a great deal of scrutiny for perfectly lawful activity. That in a number of counties, people who took advantage of Golden Week, that they took advantage, a lot of organizations and churches and other community groups had programs that were bringing people to the boards of elections during that week so that they could register and request or even cast an absentee ballot. That conduct was perfectly legal under state law and should not be a basis for suspecting or accusing people of fraud. That simply chills the voter. I talked to a number of people who were so upset by that, they're like, well, why am I gonna vote again if I'm gonna get harassed like this? So I think it's important, first of all, that we're not turning lawful activity into a basis for suspicion. We've certainly seen from boards of elections that many of you do an excellent job at investigating real suspicion, where you have reason to suspect fraud, but we should not be basing suspicion on otherwise lawful activity. And one further point along those lines that I want to clarify for those who've had this concern about Golden Week, or for that matter, people who are newly registered, whether it's someone who just turned 18 or moved to the state or what have you, voting, those votes, even if you request an absentee ballot or you cast it during the 35 days prior to an election, that vote is not counted until election day. And I think that's something we need to bear in mind. Just because someone is newly registered and they request or they cast an absentee ballot, that ballot has not been counted yet.
Mr. Fellows? Thank you, ma'am.
Except there were counties that were voting on touchscreens, correct? During that Golden Week?
Paper ballots.
I thought Franklin County, there was some voting.
Paper ballots.
Okay, well, if they did it, then that gives that ability to check. But
some of them are voting on machines, but people who are registering and voting at the same time are voting on the
poll. Oh, okay.
If you're already registered.
So if you're already registered, you can vote on the machine.
Anyone else have any comments from the panel? Before we move on to our next question, I just kind of wanted to touch base on the third question on our panel since it was already brought up. Currently, county prosecutors have original jurisdiction to investigate allegations of illegal voting, voter registration fraud, and other election issues. And so 2008 saw prosecutors acting against the wishes of bipartisan boards of elections, and in at least one instance initiated a wholesale investigation of every voter who chose to exercise their constitutionally protected rights at a specific time. Given the technical nature of elections issues and the need to have a bipartisan consideration of these issues, should the role of the county prosecutors in initiating investigations be revised, or should the Secretary of State also have the authority to investigate and refer for prosecution allegations of legal voting? And Mr. Fellows, if we can start with you on this topic.
I would say no and yes. How's that? I still think I like the decentralized form. I think it's most of your issues come up when it's locally based, and so I think the local jurisdiction should remain. However, seeing that being said, I could see a good argument in addition to that, if it seems to be some kind of a statewide situation where the Secretary of State should have that authority to not necessarily the Secretary of State, I guess, investigate as much as should it be the Attorney General, almost like what we do. We don't have investigative powers as the Board of Elections. We turn it over to our prosecutor. Should the Secretary of State, if they think that it should be something that is a statewide problem, turn it over to the Attorney General? I mean, that to me makes logical sense from where we are now, but I would never advocate for giving up our local jurisdiction.
Thank you, Mr. Fellows. Ms. Spielman?
Well, I just want to point out that we are talking about potential criminal prosecution of felonies. And to me, that is something that the officials of government who are charged with enforcing criminal laws through prosecution, we should leave it to them to a large extent. Now, that's not to say that boards of elections and the Secretary of State, if they become aware, should not tell the people in charge of criminal enforcement that there may be cause for them to follow up. As in any criminal enforcement, we rely on the good faith and the prosecutorial discretion of the prosecutors in that locality. Just as we've always had the poor with us, and we've always had people who may try and game the election laws, I'm afraid that throughout history, we've always had prosecutors who were overly zealous. And if one of the themes of this discussion that we've had over the last 2 days is that we should not throw the baby out with the bathwater and we should not overreact to individual circumstances of alleged fraud, it's my personal feeling that we should not overreact and address a problem of prosecutorial misconduct in too broad a way.
Thank you, Ms. Spielman. Ms. Newman?
Simply that I concur with both remarks, and I think the question, though, is not so much overzealous prosecutors, but to the extent you have prosecutors who are elected, then that raises the concern about partisanship in prosecutions. But I think I agree that you assume that prosecutors act in good faith and act to enforce the laws, despite the selective prosecutions we may have seen in the past.
Thank you, Ms. Newman.
I just, and that's a good point about the partisanship too. The good thing is in Ohio, I know, especially in our area, if a prosecutor can always go to a neighboring prosecutor or to another county prosecutor and ask them to handle the case if they feel it is a conflict or a situation where they may feel they need to recuse themselves, for lack of a better term. I'm not an attorney, but I guess does that make sense?
I would never argue.
Sir, I know you had a question. I really appreciate your patience. Thank you.
Third question, which you were just discussing, part of the problem in 2004 wasn't, there's this whole notion of illegal voting, although I would point out, as some already have, in the case of Acorn, if somebody has gone out and signed people up and it looks suspicious and you pointed out to the boards of elections, that to me hardly seems to be illegal, because if you destroyed those and they turned out to be actual voters with funny names, you've destroyed a public record. So that's virtually a no-win situation. But we had other problems in 04. We had people deliberately calling up or sincerely calling up and directing people to the wrong polling place. There were long discussions on this. I was called up. My polling place had closed an election before down the street, and I was directed, four houses down, but I actually voted more than half a mile away. Also, there were reports with affidavits of people closing polls, showing up, saying they were at the Board of Election, and closing polls. And in my neighborhood, in the inner city of Columbus, people walk down the street and put up flyers saying that that Democrats voted on Wednesday and Republicans on Tuesday. And I never see any of that prosecuted. You had people calling up felons and giving them the wrong information, telling them, there was a police report out of the Holiday Inn telling them that if they were in a halfway house or on probation, they couldn't vote. To me, is I think all crimes should be equally prosecuted, including those that are deliberately tampering with our elections.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Newman?
I think there would be uniform agreement that deceptive practices when it comes to voting shouldn't be tolerated. And what you described has occurred elsewhere in the country. In Virginia, voters were similarly told, if you're a Republican, vote on Tuesday. If you're a Democrat, vote on Wednesday. Many states, and I'm sure including Ohio, have deceptive practices laws that under which this kind of behavior could be investigated and prosecuted. I think it is fair to say that very often these crimes don't receive the same kind of publicity as some of the other criminal activity we've been discussing. But in Virginia, I do know that there have been investigations, if not prosecutions, of this deceptive conduct. And in New Mexico as well, in 2006, there were instances of deceptive conduct with respect to voting, and that as well was prosecuted. You guys could speak to prosecutions in Ohio better than I could.
Thanks, Ms. Newman. Mr.
Yeah,
Fellows?
I couldn't agree with you more. If those folks did stuff like that, they should absolutely be prosecuted. And I know there was one in the 2004 that I heard about, and I forget which counties it was, but it was one of those closer counties where people were calling from calling Republican households and telling them that the poll's closed and it's been changed to this location now and things like that. So it was like going both ways, and both of them should be absolutely prosecuted to the hilt. So you'll find an advocate for you on that, absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Fellows. Ms. Spielman, did you have anything to add?
I didn't add anything to those.
Okay, Ms. Peggy?
I just want it isn't really a criticism either way, but a comment that in making, as a couple of us have been making in December, started calling boards of elections about what kind of difficulties, what kind of potential fraud have you seen? We got very interesting answers. The thing that I don't know, it's sort of praising some and questioning other boards. There was vast differences in that some boards were referring every single irregularity to the county prosecutors. Other boards were trying to find out what happened, why these irregularities, and then selectively looking at the ones that looked like real fraud, and only a few were being sent to the county prosecutor or none. The kind of thing I'm talking about are things, usually elderly voters who voted absentee and then showed up at the polls. First place, this is legal. But some boards were very concerned. Well, they knew they voted absentee, and then they tried to show up and vote again, and that's, they're trying to vote twice. Other boards looked at it and said, no, that's Aunt Mabel, and she gets a little confused, and she kind of didn't remember that she'd already voted, or Cousin George was concerned that his absentee ballot wouldn't get to the board or they might not count it, and so he showed up at the board at the polls to vote, and we just said never mind. So there's a difference from county to county what they did with these. It seems like every county had a few of them, and some of them said, okay, we're not going to worry about Aunt Mabel or Uncle George. Other counties referred them all to the prosecutor, regardless. This bothers me that they're being dealt with differently. And I don't know whether it's some of them not understanding, or I just don't know. But We ended up not calling anybody after a while because, in fact, we didn't know how these were going to come. It was too soon after the election. We'll try again in the summer after we know how these come out. But we're all talking, and we know we're talking about the Hamilton County one where they investigated 600, found one, and that one self-reported. So I'm not thinking we've got massive voter fraud. I'm not worried about your guys from Pennsylvania voting, trying to vote in Lake County. Because when you send out their verification card to an Ohio address, they don't live there.
Well, the point is that they're still registered here. We don't, unless we did our due diligence, we didn't know that they moved until we got that confirmation card back and said, hey, wait, they're in New York. Now, could that be because just their mail changed? And maybe they're like just vacationing there for a while, or what? So I'm very.
But it gives you grounds for looking into it further. Right. And I do agree, right. Both the boards have to do some investigation themselves.
Right.
I do think the Secretary of State's office should have more investigative authority than it currently has, as a backup to boards, particularly if boards don't have the resources to do investigation. It would be useful for them to be able to call the Secretary of State in some instances and say, we're concerned about this situation. Do you have the resources to look into it?
Thank you, ma'am. Do we have any other comments from the panel? Sir?
I'd just like to add to things that have been said in terms of we're missing, or it's very hard to get data. I tried to investigate charges of fraud that were made at a congressional hearing in 2005 in Columbus that was handed in by a Mr. Thor Hearn from the American Center for Voting Rights. He handed in a 132-page report of, as he said, rampant fraud in Ohio. And what most of the report consisted of were newspaper articles, as you said earlier in the run-up to the election, of all kinds of cases claiming that there was fraud, a lot of it registration fraud. We had to call the county prosecutor in every single county that was mentioned in order to track this down. Some of the county prosecutors said, who are you and why do you have the right to know and everything. It was extraordinarily difficult to get the information about prosecutions for fraud. And it seems to me that is certainly a role the Secretary of State's office could do, because us citizens, it happens to, if it's on Tuesdays, the prosecutor will give you the information, and on Wednesday he won't. So that's one kind of data that I think would be very helpful. If we saw again and again, as has turned out, that out of millions of votes, there's a handful of genuine fraudulent prosecuted and convicted, and it happens again and again, then first that's data we need, but from a reliable, I mean from an official source, and then secondly, you have to think about the example that I forget which election official gave at lunchtime about the three old ladies that walked in. How many voters show up without identification and give up voting? We don't know that number. Maybe it would be nice to have poll workers write that down, a little piece of paper, so we have some idea of the discouragement of voting from the ID rules. And then thirdly, there are some numbers out there, and I wish you all would think about this, and that is that in 2006, there were, according to the EAC report, about 2,700 voters whose provisional ballots were rejected because of ID problems. You can see that data for yourself. It's in the EAC report. And in 2008, the data that just was released by the Secretary of State about a week or two ago, there's about 2,000 voters whose provisional ballots were rejected because of lack of ID. So now let's do this balancing. We all know you have to balance security of the vote against proper enfranchisement of legitimate voters. We all know that. I know you all care about it in this room. Compare 4 convicted fraudulent votes in, say, an election with millions cast against thousands known on the provisional ballot numbers to be rejected because of ID. Is that a proper balance? And then I wonder what would happen if you added these people who just leave the polls and we don't have any records. So I think the balance, if you think about it as a balance problem, A, there's missing data, it would be nice to get that data, but B, already it seems that it's wildly disproportionately on the side of disenfranchising voters.
Thank you, sir. And for the sake of time, if we can have the panel give some closing remarks as well as a response to your answer. Mr. Fellows, if we can start with you on that.
Let me jump in real quick in response to Professor Robbins' comment. First, I want to say this. I believe, and maybe some of my staff can correct me, I believe there was a directive sent to the boards after the election asking boards to report instances of prosecutions they were aware of or fraud investigations they had undertaken. I'll have to check and double check on that, but that doesn't really address your concern, which was prosecutors somehow gathering the information from all 88 county prosecutors. I believe that the county prosecutors are very protective of their own individual authority. I know there's always a tension between prosecutors' offices and the attorney general's office about, you know, staying in your own box. So there is that issue, and for the Secretary of State to come in, I believe, would require some kind of legislative change.
Thank you, Ms. Spielman. And Mr. Fellows.
Well, thanks. I'm honored to have been on the panel with Eleanor and Karen, and appreciate all the questions and the thoughts, and appreciate the dialogue. And I just do believe that, you know, our 88 county boards of elections are doing everything they can and their due diligence in making sure that no one votes illegally. And I know that's the attempt from all the boards of elections, and I think they do a great job. And we've got we just continue to need some resources sometimes to make it even better. And any more ideas, but we always have to keep one step ahead all the time.
Thank you, Mr. Fellows. Ms. Newman, any final remarks?
Sure. First of all, I also appreciated the opportunity to participate on this panel and in this discussion. And as we've been chatting, one thing that has occurred to me in the context of this discussion is that I feel very strongly that most voters are essentially like jurors. They take their role very seriously, jurors take their role very seriously in helping to decide someone's guilt or innocence. And I think voters also take their franchise extremely seriously. And it's a very rare instance indeed when you have somebody, when you're confronted with a voter or an individual who attempts to exercise that franchise illegally. To the extent it does happen, I think there are systems in place in most jurisdictions to take appropriate measures to investigate and prosecute those individuals, and I think that job is well done by state and local officials.
Thank you, Ms. Newman. And I want to thank you all for coming out tonight, and if we can take a moment here to thank our panel members real quick. Ma'am, if you had something to add.
Please forgive me, but I'm Beverly King with the Montgomery County Board of Elections. And a major component of what we do is voter education. And I would be remiss if I did not clarify that it is a myth that we discard voter registration forms. We do not want to do anything to disenfranchise any voter. And we operate under a records retention schedule. And if there is an incomplete voter registration form or complete voter registration form, it needs to be known that we do not discard them, that we must keep them in our records for a certain length of time.
Thank you, ma'am. And once again, thank you all for joining us today in this panel discussion, and I want to wish you all a very